They rob the episode of the buckle brought from the Russian general's grave to his daughter in Chittenden of the greater part of its appearance of improbability, and, taken in connection with the Compton mysteries, described in their appropriate place in this part too, indicate that we are doing no violence to our sagacity to expect that before long we may witness in our American circles phases of manifestations worthy to be classed with the ancient and modern mysteries of the countries of the Orient. The first evening I spent in Philadelphia, I had a very long conversation through wrappings with what purported to be the spirit who calls himself John King. Whoever this person may be, whether he was the buccaneer Morgan or Pontius Pilate, Columbus or Zoroaster, he has been the busiest and most powerful spirit, or what you please to call it, connected with this whole modern spiritualism. In this country and Europe we read of his physical feats, his audible speaking, his legerdemain, his direct writing, his materialization s. He was with the Coons family in Ohio, the Davenports in N.Y., the Williams in London, and the mediums in France and Germany. Me. W.B. encountered him 14 years ago in Russia and Circus A., talked with and saw him in Egypt and India. I met him in London, in 1870, and he seems able to converse in any language with equal ease. I have talked with him in English, French, German, Spanish, and Latin, and have heard others do the same in Greek, Russian, Italian, Georgian, Caucasus, and Turkish, his replies being always pertinent and satisfactory. His rap is peculiar and easily recognizable from others, a loud, sharp, crackling report. He objects to the application of tests, but after refusing them, will, at the most unexpected times, give such as are much more startling and conclusive than the ones proposed. He has done this with me, not once merely but dozens of times, and, really it became the most difficult thing in the world for me to hesitate a moment longer in giving up all reserve and acknowledging myself a spiritualist per se. I went to Philadelphia without a theory as to the Holmes imbroglio. The newspaper accounts had been so confusing that I dismissed the whole subject from my mind, and determined to start at the very bottom and build up my belief by degrees. But at my first interview with John King, he rapped out the whole secret history of the affair, telling me the parties concerned in the pretended exposure, their names, the agents they employed, the sums of money subscribed, who carried the purse, who dispersed the funds, and who received the spoils. I was amazed beyond description, for the information given was the farthest possible from what seemed credible. But each day's developments proved it more and more true, and if I could only have afforded to wait, I have little doubt but that documentary and parole evidence would have been forthcoming to substantiate the whole story. As it is, however, I will have to leave it only half told, for the bloody experience of 1692 stands as a warning for all time against relying wholly upon spectre testimony. It will be readily imagined that I early demanded of the supposed spirit some evidence of his supersensual existence. On the evening of the 6th, I said to him, "If you are in reality a spirit, as you pretend, give me some exhibition of your power. Make for me, for example, a copy of the last note from Eliza White to Mr. that I have and the portfolio in my pocket." He made no reply, but rattled on about other matters, and did not recur to the subject that evening. On the evening of the 8th, however, as we were sitting by the table, me, W.B., writing and I reading, John rapped loudly for the alphabet, and spelt out, "Hand me your dictionary, under the table, will you?" Me, W.B., did as requested. The mucilage. She handed the bottle down. "Your penknife." She passed that down also. All was quiet for a moment, when he rapped that we should look. We took up the dictionary and lo, upon a flyleaf in the back part, we found an exact copy of the note I had referred to evenings before, the portfolio in which I carried it, with other documents relating to the case, I had taken out of my pocket a half hour before, and laid upon the mantel shelf. With this exception, it had not been out of my possession, and the whole time it lay on the mantel, it was under my eye and I sat within a few feet of it. It was impossible, therefore, for any trickster to have secretly transferred a duplicate to my friend's dictionary. I crossed over, got the paper, and compared it, and here we have the two in facsimile. By placing the one over the other, I found that the duplicate was not a tracing, for, while the two fitted in certain places, they would not in others, and there were just such differences in the formation of the letters as showed that the duplicate might have been written by the same person as the other, but at a different time. The reader will observe the very quaint writing in the footnote of the duplicate, signed J. K. This is supposed to be John's own autograph, and another example of it will be found on the communication of Katie King to myself. It will be imagined that I awaited the fulfillment of his promise the next evening with great interest, not to say anxiety, but I said nothing for fear his worship might be induced to postpone the matter indefinitely. Me. D. B. And I were alone this time, occupied as before, when suddenly at John's demand, expressed through rappings, she took a sheet of Bristol board drawing paper, and showing me that both sides were perfectly clean, threw it under the table. I glanced under the cloth to see that there was nothing there but the one piece of paper, which was easily recognizable by its size and shape. John rapped that I should look at my watch, and note how long it took him to perform the experiment. Madame de B. went on with her writing, and no sound was heard but the scratching of her pen and the ticking of my watch. When 30 seconds had elapsed, John rapped done, and upon going beneath the table, and seeing the paper, I made an exclamation of disappointment, for the upper surface was blank. But as I lifted the sheet from the floor, I saw, upon the face that had lain next to the carpet, a second copy of the same document. The difference in the formation of the letters between the original and duplicate is not nearly so marked as those between this triplicate and the original. Mr. B. Danely came in at this moment and we compared the writings with the greatest care, only to be more and more astounded at this fresh exhibition of the power of our invisible ally. Now let the reader turn to the story of the visit of the two Egyptian gentlemen to the old sheikh, on page 44. And then to the facsimiles of the writings done for me by the spirits at Chittenden, which look so suspiciously like Horatio Eddy's autograph, and decide whether the mere fact of such resemblances as all these, would be any proof positive that a medium had been committing fraud if he should give us communications in handwriting very much like his own. The portfolio containing Eliza White's Katie King note and John's first duplicate was this time in my coat pocket, where it had been constantly since the preceding evening. John broke in upon our expressions of surprise by rapping out, "Do you folks want me to commit forgery for you? I can bring you here the blank check of any national bank, and sign upon it the name of any president, cashier or other official." I thanked His Invisible Highness kindly and declined the favor, upon the sufficient ground that the police did not believe in spiritualism, and I did not care to risk the chance of convincing them in case the forged papers should be found in my possession. I devoted an idle hour this same day to an interview with a very remarkable impressible medium, named Miss Annie M. Bulwer, to whom I was recommended by Mr. Rowan and Dr. Child. I went to her a perfect stranger, declined to give my name, and nevertheless, was more interested by what she told me than by anything I ever got in the same length of time from a person of her class. She told me my name, described the business upon which I had come to Philadelphia, spoke of the probable result, which, I may say, has been in great measure verified, and favored me with sundry prophecies, two of which I record as a matter of curiosity. Among other things, she said that I would be invited to England before long, to act with Messrs. Wallace, Crooks, and Varley in an important matter connected with spiritualism, to arise in the future, and that my present book would be translated into Russian, German, Polish, and other languages. Part of her prediction is already in a fair way of being verified, for the Russian translation is almost finished, and I am informed that the work is to be republished in German, at Leipzig. I pray the reader's indulgence for this digression, but so few dash prophecies from these mediums are placed upon record in advance, that I thought there would be no harm in breaking through the rule. Mrs. Holmes returned from Vineland on the 11th, and that evening I attended for the first time a séance at her house. There were present 15 persons. The first thing in order was a dark séance, which I will not particularly dwell upon, as I afterwards had the opportunity of holding one in my own rooms, under test conditions, and will allude to it in its proper place. I found the cabinet a triangular, bottomless box, standing in the corner of the room before a window, just as described in Eliza White's story in the papers, but I made no remark about it or any of the arrangements that evening, as I wished to see how things were done. Mrs. Holmes, of course, occupied the cabinet alone, her husband being in the country. She went in and sat upon a chair, closed and bolted the door from the inside, and somebody outside started a large music box to playing. 459. In a few minutes the short, black curtain behind one of the apertures was drawn aside, and a man's head appeared, as if floating in the air. It was ghastly pale, a heavy black beard and moustache increasing the unnatural pallor by contrast. I went up to the aperture, leaned my arm upon the bracket shelf beneath it, and gazed into the face, which was not 12 inches from me. A more dreadful sight I had never beheld. The lower portions, including the wavy silky beard, were perfectly formed, as also was the brow, but the eyes were not materialized, and the cavities they should have filled were edged with ragged rims, as though the face had been made of wax and the eyes melted out by the application of a red-hot iron. To see the thing floating in the air as buoyantly as a cork in water, and then gaze at the orbless sockets, was calculated to test weak nerves to the fullest extent. "Well," I said to the head, "you are a handsome young man, and no mistake. Do you think any damsel of taste would fall in love with such a face as that?" The lips smiled, and the head wagged from side to side to mark dissent. I asked many questions, and was answered by nods and shakes, to signify yes and no. A well-formed masculine hand, matching in color the ghastly face, came up and stroked the beard, and motioned to me to do likewise. I passed my hand inside, and felt the beard, and found it soft, silky, and as warm in temperature as my own. But I was not satisfied with the séance, for the medium was not under test conditions, and the cabinet stood where it did during the time when Eliza White's pretended comedy was being enacted. Moreover, I was not satisfied with the movements of the head. They were too stiff and constrained, and made me think I had possibly been looking at a cleverly made mask, or inflated rubber head, although I had never seen its like before. The next morning I procured some stout unbleached sheeting, and had a capacious bag made with a drawstring at its mouth. It was large enough to take in Mrs. Holmes up to her neck, leaving her room enough to be comfortable. I also went to the house, and myself moved the cabinet from its place in the corner to the other side of the room, against a dead wall. Around its two sides mosquito netting was tacked to prevent any possible admission of a confederate, through a movable panel. With a screwdriver I carefully tested every screw, and found that instead of any one or two being looser than the rest, and so corroborating Eliza's story that she had screwed and unscrewed them at every séance, each was as solid in the wood as every other one. I found that Mrs. Holmes measured 5 feet 3 inches in height, while the lower edge of the aperture was 5 feet 5 inches from the floor. When she stood upon tiptoe, the top of her head was just visible from the outside, through the aperture. Here we have a front view and ground plan of the cabinet. It is made of imitation black walnut, ornamented in front with mouldings and panels. The two sides of the triangle are of matched pine boards, but the furnace heat has shrunken them so that in places the tongues have slipped out of the grooves, and light can be seen through the cracks. The sketch shows the mosquito netting tacked around the sides. Just as Mrs. Holmes was ready to enter the cabinet, I stopped her and said that as she had consented to submit to test conditions, I should now begin to apply them, with her permission. She assented, whereupon I produced the bag, and she got into it. I secured myself effectually, I believed, against fraud by drawing the mouth around her neck, just tight enough to admit of her breathing, without its choking her. I then sealed the string, close up, with sealing wax, and stamped it with my ring. Finally, I removed the chair from the cabinet, and left her to stand up. I pushed the door to, and it was immediately bolted on the inside. The light was made very dim, and we awaited results. In less than 3 minutes, a white hand appeared at one of the apertures. It had no rings upon the fingers, Mrs. Holmes had several on hers. Her hand, moreover, is of a very peculiar shape, its outlines being full of curves, and the fingers long and bony, with the phalanges strongly defined. The hand shown was plump, well-shaped and large. Then, after a few minutes, there came into view a partially materialized female face, much worse to look upon than the male one of the preceding evening. I could not think of anything to compare it with except the face of a corpse, half eaten by rats or crabs. It was framed in a drapery of white muslin stuff, and, like the other, floated in the air, swimming towards the aperture, now from one side, and now from the other, or rising from below, then remaining stationary for a moment or so. It gazed at us in a stiff, blank way, with its eyeless sockets, and its half-formed features, until it was enough to make one's flesh creep to look at it. But I went up, stared at it and talked with it by means of its nods and shakes, until it was able to tell me that it was the head of Katie King, herself, badly materialized. Its peculiarities, aside from the dreadful raggedness of its half-made-up features, were a preternatural narrowness of chin and forehead, and a marked redness of lips, as though they were stained with vermilion. I doubt if ever a late supper conjured a worse vision out of the realm of dreams to affright the dyspeptic withal, than this one, but it was in a measure, more satisfactory than a perfect visage would have been, for, the medium being helplessly confined within the bag, and no possibility of confederacy existing, it seemed to show that the face was neither that of a human being, nor yet a mask, for such masks are never made. It came several times within sight, and then disappeared for the evening. Upon entering me, W.S. rooms this evening, I found several ladies and gentlemen waiting to be introduced to me, and they were amusing themselves with some mind-reading tests given by a boy medium named DeWitsey Huff. One gentleman mentally requested that an affirmative answer to his mental question should be indicated, by the lads leading him across the room and placing his, the gentleman's, hand upon a portrait of John King, in a glazed frame, that hung upon the wall. This was done, when to our surprise it was found that the glass over the little picture had disappeared, although it had been noticed in its usual place the same day. This glass was not restored until nearly a week had elapsed, when, one evening, John rapped that he wanted a very small piece of white paper passed under the table, and presently said that he had brought the glass back again. Sure enough, there it was, with the small strip of paper gummed on it, and a line in John's handwriting to the effect that he had had it away with him. In entering this circumstance in my notebook, I appended, by way of pleasantry, the slang expression "bully for John." It will be seen further on how he returned the compliment. The next morning, the 13th, Mr. Rowan, Mr. B. Tainerly and I went to Mrs. Holmes' house without pre-announcement to hold a private séance. The windows were darkened, Mrs. Holmes was put into the bag, which was sealed as before, and the chair was removed. In 70 seconds from the time the door was closed, a hand was shown at the aperture. I approached the window, and laying my hand upon the sill, it was patted by a detached hand, which I found soft, plump, warm and moist. My hand was then gently pulled down inside the cabinet and pressed between two hands and caressed. I asked that I might be allowed to feel the two thumbs at once, and upon opening my hand the two thumbs were laid between my thumb and forefinger, and I pressed them. Mr. Rowan's hand was then pressed and caressed. Passing my hand within again I felt and stroked the man's beard, as on the former occasion, and afterwards the turban top of a head was raised just up to the aperture, but the face was not shown. Finally, all three of us laid a hand each upon the sill, and each was patted by turns. These were all of the materializations of the séance, but just before its close a whispering voice addressed me in German from within the cabinet, giving me the name Katrina Gobi, and saying that she had died some years before, in Philadelphia. Mrs. Holmes is said to be unacquainted with any language but English. John King showed himself very clearly at the evening séance, coming as many as 20 times in sight, and allowing a number of people to approach him and shake hands or stroke his beard. I stood at the aperture as long as I chose. His eyes were perfectly formed tonight, and moved about, and winked in a very natural manner. He smiled at me, shook hands, and talked quite at length. I requested him to float his head up so high that everyone could see that it was not possible for Mrs. Holmes either to be wearing a mask, or holding one up, whereupon he rose to the extreme top of the window and thrust his head outside, at an elevation of 6 feet 7 inches from the floor. One of the perplexing features of the Katie King affair was the supposed resemblance between the manuscript of Eliza White and that of the notes given by Katie to Mr. Robert Dale Owen, Dreyfelger and others, at the home seances. I determined to attempt at least the procurement of a communication to myself from Katie, and so, thinking the moment propitious, I asked if Katie would favor me. The answer came in a whisper, "I'll do it, Colonel, if I can get power enough." I then passed through the aperture a sheet of notepaper that I had purchased on my way from my lodgings, and that was marked in a way to effectually prevent their palming off upon me a prepared communication. Upon another sheet, as Eliza White avers Mr. Owen was deceived in the matter of the Fred W. Robertson writing. Whatever became of my paper, it disappeared, for, as soon as the seance was over, I searched thoroughly all about and no trace of it could be found. The next day at 2:30 p.m., I had a seance at my own rooms. A cabinet was improvised out of the short square passage between the sitting and bedroom, and a curtain of black paper muslin, with two windows cut in it, and short curtains hanging over them inside, so as to be raised or dropped at will, was tacked over the sitting room door. Those present upon this occasion were me, De Blavitsky, Honorable Robert Dale Owen, Dr. Felger, Mr. B. Tainelli, the medium Mrs. Holmes, and myself. The rear door of the passage was sealed by Mr. Owen with strips of thin paper, after Mrs. Holmes had been sealed up in the bag. Mr. Owen also locked the bedroom door leading into the passage, and put the key into his pocket. We then darkened the room and took our places close to the curtain. In half a minute hands were shown, and, almost immediately John King's face appeared and was thrust quite through the aperture. He was perfectly materialized, and came as near being a handsome man as he ever did, I presume, and that is quite near. A voice, supposed to be Katie's, spoke to us, and calling up Mr. Owen and myself, she, or, at all events, a female hand patted our hands. I asked if she had written the communication to me yet, but she said she had not. I then requested that she would hand me the paper so that I might show it to Mr. Owen. In a moment it was thrust through the aperture, and Mr. Owen, examining it by the light, found no writing except what I had written in French in the middle of the page. I passed the paper back, and it was taken from my hand. John King allowed Mr. Owen to feel his hand and beard, and, altogether, the manifestations were quite as satisfactory, if not more so, than any I had thus far seen at Mrs. Holmes' house. They proved beyond question the fact that, whatever they may be, they depend for their production neither upon false panels, nor trapdoors, nor wire machinery. The séance terminated about 5 o'clock. The public séance was held at 825 North 10th Street, at 8 p.m., as usual. A gentleman present suggested that I should tie Mrs. Holmes' hands together before putting her into the bag, and I did so. But, to tell the truth, I thought the precaution so unnecessary that the tying was a mere pretense. I considered it perfectly impossible for her to get her hands outside the bag to use any masks, even if she had such concealed about her. John King appeared as usual and allowed 6 or 7 persons, beside myself, to approach and converse with him or shake hands. As I saw his head floating free in the air within a few inches of my eyes, I recalled Eliza's assertion that the faces were 10-cent masks manipulated by the medium, and the idea occurred to ask permission to satisfy myself in the most conclusive way that I was not looking at a mechanical contrivance. John assenting, I then put my arm in, and swept the air in a semicircle beneath his head, coming into contact with neither stick, nor wire, nor medium's arm. The drooping ends of his white turban dragged over my hand as I withdrew it. I then requested him to depress his head, and passed my arm in like manner as before, completely over his head, thus finding that it was not suspended from above by string or wire. I handed John my signet ring and asked him to hold it for a moment so that I might hereafter have it as a souvenir of the evening's parley. One of the ladies handed him the ring also, for the same purpose. He soon returned the second ring, but said he should keep mine, which I must say I did not fancy, as it was an expensive intaglio, and I was not in the mood of making presents to detached heads and hands. Before releasing Mrs. Holmes from the bag at the close of the séance, I searched the cabinet in every part, but my ring was gone. The voice of Katie called me up to the cabinet after I had resumed my seat, and a hand passed out to me the sheet of paper I had handled a few hours before. The previously blank surface was now covered with two communications to me, in a handwriting which seems to be identical with the Katie King notes of last summer, addressed to Dr. Felger and Mr. Rowan, here given. Let the reader judge for himself. Compare the handwriting of these with that of the paper received by me from Katie, here given. That in the center square is my own. Such of the persons present as witnessed the delivery of the paper to me then signed a certificate at my request, and the séance was brought to a close. 468. A fresh surprise was in store for me that night, for when I was about retiring, I turned down the pillow to put my watch beneath it, arid there lay my ring uninjured. Its weight is 7½ pennyweights, and the distance it had been transported was perhaps 3/4 of a mile. On Monday evening, January 19, I returned from a short visit to Hartford, and attended the séance at the usual place. Mr. Holmes and his wife were both present this evening, the former having recovered sufficiently from his hemorrhages to bear traveling. Mrs. Holmes went inside this evening, and her husband sat outside. I placed a guitar inside the cabinet. Instantly after I closed the door, a hand was shown at the aperture. The guitar was played upon, floated about, bumping against the sides and roof of the cabinet, and was violently thrust through the aperture. The face of John King was shown, but none other, and nothing unusual occurred, except a violent altercation between some visitors and the Holmeses, as to whether it was possible for the former to pass their hands through the neck of the bag. I determined that there should be no longer any doubt upon this subject, so the next evening I took special care in sealing the bag. I closed the mouth very tight and sealed the strings with wax to a silver coin in such a way that any attempt to open or loosen the mouth would break the wax. I had a friend present, an eminent inventor, who made a thorough examination of the bag and pronounced it impossible for any trickery to be resorted to. I also caused Mrs. Holmes to drop her arms by her side, and then pinned her sleeves to the bag in such a way that she could not raise her hands more than 4 inches from the perpendicular. I had caused to be attached to the left-hand aperture, at the inside, a cage or basket of wire cloth, with an arched crown and flat bottom, intending to have the faces or hands show themselves within it, if possible. Before closing the cabinet door I requested that the bolt should be thrown back instantly after being shot, so that I might see if Mrs. Holmes were moving from her position in the apex of the triangular box. This was done. I stood ready with hand upon the latch, and the moment the bolt was drawn I pulled the door open, and the medium was standing motionless in her bag. 469. Two guitars placed inside were now played upon simultaneously, and pushed out of the right-hand aperture. Within 1 minute a hand was shown at the same window, then the curtain over the other aperture, and within the cage, was drawn aside. How? A hand was then shown there, so that all of the 30 persons present saw it. Then John King appeared at the right window frequently, and sundry persons, including General Lippitt, who was present for the first time to begin an investigation of the Holmes affair, my friend the inventor, and others. The wire basket appearing to be too small to permit of the perfect formation of a head within it, I had the mechanics enlarge it the next day, by removing the flat bottom and carrying the sides down to the floor. I also had it permanently attached to the face of the cabinet by staples and wire ties that passed through the boards and were twisted and cut off on the front face. Here are the certificates of the workmen Philadelphia, January 19th. 1875. This is to certify that we have attached to the left-hand aperture of the cabinet in the parlor of 825 North 10th Street, in this city, a wire basket with a flat bottom and curved sides and crown, the meshes of which are at a distance of 1/3 inch apart, or what is known in the trade as number 3 wire cloth, that the said basket is permanently attached to the said cabinet by staples, and that it would be impossible for any person to introduce a hand, face, or any other thing of greater diameter than 1/3 of an inch, within the said basket, without removing it by drawing the staples out of the wood. W. L. Wilson, W. M. H. Fenn, with J. E. Fenth, wire worker, number 36 N. 6th Street, Philadelphia, January 20, 1875.